Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Stormkeep, How to Counter Everything number 4. We are talking about the Kronspine Incarnate of Gur, a new model released in one of those little FOMO boxes that Games Workshop really loves doing. Today I'm joined with, as always, my good buddy Murgonk.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
And a new Night Podcast store, Jack the Calamitous. And for you One Piece fans out there, that is not a reference, I promise.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
So How to Counter Everything is an ongoing series on the Stormkeep. We typically look at popular lists and units and factions in the tournament scene. We look at what makes them strong or popular and explain their game plan. We talk about what makes them good, what weaknesses they have, and how you can take advantage of those weaknesses in order to counter them, suggesting strategies for how to beat the armies that these are included in. And in particular, we tend to focus on Stormcast units because we are the Stormkeep after all, so we got to look at Stormcast. The Kronspine Incarnate of Gur is kind of a weird one. Kind of reminds me of the Bellicor video that we did a while back, because this one has a very particular rule set that is difficult for most players to find because it's inside a single limited release box with a bunch of terrain. So most people aren't going to have access to this, and it has a completely new rule set that we haven't seen in any other unit so far in the game. So it's complicated. It's hard to it's hard to get the rules. And then you have to also figure out how to beat it. And there's only like a very specific way on how to counter these things because of their rule set. So in addition to all of that, it's also a fast and punchy monster. And it could be used by literally any army in the game. So any army that wants a fast, punchy monster, which most armies right now do, are going to be likely to use this thing. And yeah, so we wanted to do a video talking about how you can kill it. So, Jack, run us through incarnates and how they work.
Incarnates are a, we're assuming, going to be a series of monsters that are tied to the various mortal realms. When you add this to your list, it is added similarly to the way that mercenaries are, where you add it to your list, but that then uses up all of your allies' slots. And with the incarnates, when you add it to your list, you assign it to a hero as a unique enhancement. So the heroes can't be a named character, a unique character. They have to be one of the generic heroes from the army. They do not have a wounds characteristic. It's assigned a wounds characteristic of 18 for any ability that needs to reference wounds. Instead, it has a series of states that work similarly to a monster's damage table. It begins the game at level 2, and there are ways for it to go up a level. It caps at level 3. When you allocate wounds to it, you do so normally. And in the battle shock phase, the controlling player rolls 3d6. And if they roll equal to or under the number of wounds that's been allocated, it's reduced its level by 1. If they roll above, then they negate the wounds entirely and it stays where it is. The incarnate is bonded to a hero as a unique enhancement when you add it to your list. Again, that means that if it's a unique or named character, this cannot be bound to it. And then each incarnate gives bonuses when the hero is within its aura. We're assuming that the incarnates or the incarnates of other mortal realms are going to work the same way. For the Incarnate of Gur, it's plus 1 to cast. And if the hero is slain, the incarnate immediately goes to wild form. While it's in wild form, it's still a part of your army. However, it treats all models on the table, friend and foe, as enemy models, and therefore it has to attack if it's within range.
Right, and an important note here is that in Age of Sigmar 3rd edition, just because you are in range to make a pylon move, like if you're within 3 inches, you can be selected to fight and make a pylon move, but you don't have to make the pylon move. The rules very clearly state you can make a pylon move, but you must attack if you're in range. So that little distinction there is important for a model like this.
It absolutely is. Unfortunately, I'm sure it's by design, the range of its melee attacks are 1 inch and 2 inches. So if it is within, just at 3 inches or just within 3, you could choose to not pile in and therefore its attacks would be out of range.
Yeah, no, maybe in the future they'll release one that has a 3-inch range attack, which would be a lot more interesting, frankly. Because if it's wild, it's just fighting you every turn. You can't stop it. That would be cool. And like you said, there's probably going to be one for every realm. Or maybe this is a case where they release a cool thing and it seems like it has a lot of potential, and then they just forget about it and never do another one. Well, we have no idea what's going to happen, so we'll see.
Depends on how the box sells, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Right?
They've probably got at least one more like ready to release in the pipeline, and then probably like the third or fourth one that gets released is dependent on the sales, if I had to guess. Because like this is how their production schedule usually goes. They're about 2 years behind. So they're trying to guess what people are going to buy 2 years from now, which... Good luck, man. That's not an easy business model.
Especially when there's delays in production schedules and it sets you way, way back.
Right. So Morgonk, run us through specifically the Kronspine Incarnate of Gur, that's fun to say, and what players can expect to see when it's on the table.
When, as Jack mentioned, this thing works off of levels, and when it gets empowered, when this model slays a monster, or I think eats an endless spell, it's got, like it's not mentioned here, but it can basically use a monster's action to try and eat an endless spell to gain a level. There's something called a domination range, which is, I think, as it goes up the levels, it goes from 8 to 10 to 12, and a domination range is basically a range where... it has an aura of all-out attack, or like it doesn't let people retreat. And I think it's a plus to cast for the bonded wizard and a minus to cast for non-bonded wizards within that range. In the bonded state, it can only receive commands, like Jack mentioned, from the bonded hero. If it receives all-out attack, every friendly unit within domination range, wholly within domination range, also receives the command, if they have not received another command. Like I said, the bonded hero will probably have a plus one to cast, dispel and unbind, and any non-bonded hero will have a minus one. The wild form is a plus one to hit, which means when it goes wild, you don't need to issue commands to it anymore, which is really neat. And it can run and charge, but it must charge if it's within 12 inches of any enemy unit or friendly unit or endless spell. However, like this never really comes up because once it starts running and charging, you can pretty safely put it outside 12 of any friendly models. So if you're careful with this model, it's actually better to have it in wild form sometimes. You're going to lose out on the aura because you can't, you know, issue commands to a whole bunch of units, all out attack being the command. But it just becomes a sort of more independent monster piece on the field. Inflame Savagery, like I said, within domination range, can reroll, run, and charge rolls, cannot retreat. And like I said, the wizards that aren't the bonded wizard have a minus one to cast and bind and dispel. But all in all, a pretty decent monster, has some cool and interesting buffs, some cons, but really you can mitigate those with great positioning. The next thing is Arcane Predator, which you basically finish a charge within half an inch of an endless spell. You use the Devour Endless spell instead of another monster's Rampage, and I think the way it goes is you pick one endless spell within three, roll 2d6, and if you roll over its casting value, you dispel it and you gain one level. But if you miss it, if you fail on that roll, you lose a level. The good thing to note about this is you cannot cheat the incarnate by casting your own endless spell and having the incarnate eat it. It must be cast by enemy wizards, which I don't think is an FAQ target. I'm of the opinion it's not an FAQ target.
The FAQ target would be if the wizard cast it when it was friendly and then that wizard is dead. Was the spell cast by a friendly wizard or a dead wizard? Because it's no longer on the field, so is it affected by abilities of models that are on the battlefield? It's like this weird gray area. So that's what the FAQ note is there for.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's fair. Yeah, that's a good target for an FAQ. I think all in all, just you'll probably never be using this because endless spells generally outside of Umbral Spell Portal aren't that common in the meta currently. And maybe that'll change now that, you know, Nighthaunt's coming out and Sylvanas coming out.
Definitely, it sees more play when you're running these kinds of lists that try to kill your own wizard in order to make your incarnate go wild, and then you eat your own spells because, you know, presumably it's cast by an enemy wizard. That's kind of its main use. Most players just typically don't use endless spells, and the fact that you risk losing a level if you fail that roll, and there's no way to re-roll this or add anything except your current level, so you're rolling 2d6 plus 2 over the cast value of a spell, there's still a decent failure chance. And once we get into the mechanics of how this thing fights and then takes damage, it's really brutal if you ever fail that cast or that devour roll.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the Kron Spine good at, and why do people care so much? Well, first off, it does a lot of melee damage, a really decent chunk of melee damage with high rend and good accuracy. And it does scale based on its level. So, for example, here we've merged the damage, the attacks and damage characteristics together just to get an idea of how much damage this thing's going to do. You can see at level 2, its claws are going to do 16 damage. At 3s and 3s, rend 2. And its fangs are going to do 12 damage. At 3s and 2s, rend 3. These are both very accurate attacks, especially because this guy will most likely be getting plus 1 hit from all-out attack. So these are going to be on 2s and 3s or 2s and 2s with good rend values. So these are decent attacks, right? It's about 28 damage right off the bat, and if you manage to eat an endless spell or kill a monster, it's going to scale up, and that's not something to sneeze at. The way incarnates work is they lose levels rather than dying, and since they start at level 2 and you have to reduce them to level 0 in order for them to be removed from the board, that means they require a minimum of 2 turns to kill, because you have to roll in the battle shock phase on your opponent's turn, and then you have to roll in the battle shock phase on another turn after that. And that's not easy to do. That means it always gets to fight in the combat phase. So even if you charge in and deal the 18 wounds you need to deal with it to guarantee that it's going to fail that roll at the end of the turn, it's still going to punch you back. And with its good attacks, that's pretty scary. You're always trading down when you fight a Kron Spine. Another really good thing for the Kron Spine, and what a lot of lists are using it for, is the all-out attack issued on all friendly units around it. As well, if you're in that range, you're also going to be re-rolling run and charge. So for very aggressive melee-focused armies that want that extra mobility and command point efficiency, this thing is a great inclusion. And when you factor in that it can't be killed, it also adds this great defensive utility for that turn. In addition to all of that, it's also pretty fast, 12-inch flying move, and when it's in wild form, it can run and charge, which is pretty speedy. It has the monster keyword, so it can use all the different monstrous rampages, it can score battle tactics and grand strategies and Gur, it gets bonus victory points, and it itself, since it takes 2 turns to kill, doesn't feed your opponent victory points like a lot of other monsters would. Also note that when it's removed from play, that doesn't count as being slain for the purposes of the Predators and Prey rule. So you don't get bonus victory points with battle tactics like Bring It Down, but it can be the target of Bring It Down, which is a weird interaction, but that's how it works.
Is it because the models, enemy models, technically aren't killing it? It's sort of dying of its own volition?
Yeah. It
is not slain. So the rule that it uses is removed from play. And in the core rules, when the last model of a unit is removed from play, it is counted as being destroyed. So anything that triggers off of the word slain doesn't apply to this thing. But Bring It Down says that you complete the battle tactic when the monster is destroyed.
Right. And you score bonus victory points if it was slain by an attack from a monster. Since you can never slay this thing, it just gets removed. It's a really weird niche thing, but and maybe it won't even be relevant because the new General's Handbook coming out in a few months might just completely make that invalid. So it's not worth spending too much time thinking about it. But it is. Okay. It should be worth noting. If you're like a high-end tournament player, you should consider that. Like you mentioned, Murgonk, even when this thing's wild, you still control its movement. And since it has a 12-inch flying move and running and charging when it's wild, it's really easy to get it in the position that you want it to be. So the downside of it having to charge, and in theory it would charge your own army and fight you, it rarely happens in that way because it's so easy to move this thing into the spot you need with its speed. It's also only 400 points. Like, a lot of armies would want to take this unit in their army. Like, if it didn't have, like, fancy, like, just the stats and the abilities, a lot of armies would take 400 points for that. It's just a well-costed beatstick monster.
I mean, every army that has a beatstick monster at this point level usually just gets shot off the board. Like, you think of, like, Flesh Eater Court Terrorgeist, for instance. And this is a monster that you literally cannot Alpha Strike off the board turn one.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this thing is going to be around to smack you in the face.
Yeah, for a minimum of 2 turns. It's like, you know, it's got the Marathi's Ironheart of Cain in a sense. So it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And let's look at typically what people are doing with it is they'll, you know, like we mentioned, there's very aggressive melee armies that want to use this thing as a supporting unit that also charges in alongside them. So you could definitely see this with something like Idoneth Deepkin. They have a very aggressive eel type army. I'm not suggesting that's a great list. I'm just trying to give you an archetype of what would run this. Stormcast could use this alongside some drakes. You can charge them all in together, getting a reroll charge and run aura. Since the reroll isn't a command, you could also use this with, what's our holy command called?
Steadfast March.
Yes.
Steadfast March.
Thank you. You could use this with Steadfast March to push your drakes up even further. And this works in all phases. So if you're doing a run or charge in the hero phase, for example, like with Stormdrake Guard, it also allows you to reroll that. It's just a very solid ability, and there's a lot of armies that do run and charge these days. I can definitely see Daughters of Cain will really like this thing because they run in charge and they can reroll both. It's going to be great. So that's the main use of it, is as an offensive tool. And then also there's this other side of it that because it's guaranteed to survive at least one turn, and it requires two turns to kill, the Kronspine can hold territory like nothing else in the game can. This is like a mini Marathi that every army can use. And because it's a monster, it also counts as five models. So you can't just, you know, get it tied into some combat with a small unit or something. You actually need to dedicate resources that will survive combat with this thing in order to contest objectives that it's holding. And because it's so hard to kill and because it presents such a threat, your opponent has to dedicate serious resources into this two turns in a row. And that first turn that they're putting damage into it accomplishes literally nothing. Nothing changes in terms of board state. You just get a redo, like, okay. And because of how Aegis Sigmar turns work, sometimes you get two turns in a row and you can blow it off the table, but other times the opponent gets two turns in a row and this thing eats a bunch of endless spells and kills some monsters and then the game's just over. Like, it can snowball out of control.
If it goes up a level, it becomes insanely hard to kill after that, because then you're talking about minimum two more turns of trying to deal with this thing.
Yeah, and any time it gains a level is almost like almost a loss right off the bat. You have to really make sure this thing never gains a level.
Yeah, it definitely requires a lot of coordination and strategy when you're facing off against one of these things.
Right. But it does have very particular weaknesses. So let's take a look at those, because it doesn't seem like it has a lot, but the more you look at it and the more you play with it, you can see some start to emerge. So although it takes two turns to kill, it does have a lot of trouble negating and avoiding damage. It's a big base. It's not a subtle creature. It's not teleporting around. It's moving in a pretty much a defined direction, because you know what your opponent's going to want to hit, and it only has a 4-up save with no ward, so just pour damage into it, and it will take the 18 wounds you need in order to guarantee that it's going to lose a level. Another big weakness with this thing is that it only does melee damage, which doesn't seem like a weakness, but when you consider a lot of armies that would want to use this don't necessarily just want to spend 400 points on more melee units. They might want to bring something like more sharks for shooting or more bow snakes for shooting. If you have options for shooting, you need to bring them in order to tear down screens. Like, this doesn't give your army anything it doesn't already have, because every army can melee. Well, maybe not Caradhron, but every army pretty much does melee combat. So this just adds to that. It's not giving you a unique functionality your army doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the melee damage it does, if you can strike first or make this thing strike last and then, you know, retreat out of combat or pile in out of range or something, you can really mess with it, because it's a very straightforward fighter. Think of it like a Maw Crusher. It doesn't have any tricks once it gets into combat. All it does is it hits you really hard. And that kind of damage, because it's high damage and high rend, you can negate it with things like Scaly Skin or the Cruel Grass Cruciator's ability, which reduce damage by one, or effects that ignore rend. Like, if you have an Ethereal Ghost, you don't care about a Kronspine having rend 3 attacks. It doesn't matter to you.
Mm-hmm.
Another weakness here is that it doesn't have a 3-inch range weapon. It's limited to its 1-inch and 2-inch weapons, which means you can put a unit 2.5 inches from your front line. The Kronspine will charge in, fight the screen, and then your next unit can riposte immediately from 2.5 inches away. And it's not a hero, so it can't use Heroic Recovery or their Finest Hour in order to try to heal up some wounds between turns. Although, I guess in this particular case, it wouldn't matter, because you roll every Battle Shock phase and then start of the hero phase happens. Maybe if there was like some damage at the start of the hero phase or something, it could matter. But no, it can't use Finest Hour, and that's the biggest one, I think, because it can't save stack that effectively. You need to cast Mystic Shield on it, you need to issue all its defense on it, and only the bonded hero can issue all its defense on it. So if you can shut him down, then this thing becomes easier to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because it can't issue commands by itself. It can only receive them. So and the bonded hero can only issue one command per phase. So if you have some other really cool ability that hero's trying to use, well, he has to choose between this one or issuing a command to the Ground Spine. If you issue all-out defense, you can't issue all-out attack to three units, which is a big draw of this thing. Thinking about how Iron Jaws can issue all-out attack or all-out defense to multiple units at the same time, this guy can only get that effect from all-out attack. It's not a defensive boost at all to bring this guy. Aside from its own durability, of course. Like we mentioned before, devouring an endless spell risks having it lose a level. It itself cannot retreat, so it can get stuck in bad combats. Like, if this guy gets stuck fighting a 1-plus save Star Drake that's rerolling saves, it's going to have a bad time because it's not going to do any damage. It has a fixed threat range of 12-inch move plus 12-inch charge, which means if you deploy 24 out of 24 inches on turn 1, it does nothing on turn 1. So that's actually quite a lot lower threat range than something like a Mach Rusha or Idoneth Deepkin with their additional speed. It's until it goes wild, it's actually not that fast. It's fast, but not so fast that you can't avoid it on turn 1.
And it doesn't fly, does it?
It does fly.
It does fly? Okay. That somewhat helps. Because, yeah, like 12-inch, like we think of 12-inch range, like it's fast, don't get me wrong, but like that's the range on a lot of the Stormcast things, like Chariots and stuff. And that's a decent threat range, but the ones that are really fast in this game probably have like 16-inch moves or 14-inch moves.
Yeah.
Those are threatening.
It's usually something like 10-inch plus run in charge or serious bonuses to run in charge or 14 inches. 10 to 12 inches is a weird area.
Mm-hmm.
It feels fast, but not fast enough to reliably charge on turn 1. And when a game is usually decided by the bottom of 2, that deployment and being able to charge on turn 1 is really big. So if your opponent could just deploy 24.1 inches out and your Kron Spine gets no damage output on the first turn, that's a lot of points. It's not doing anything.
And it's not maneuverable. Like, this thing is on the 130 millimeter base, the same one that like the Terror Geists are on.
And the Gargan base, basically.
Yeah, basically. Because it's so big, the fact that it can fly doesn't really come into play. Because its base is so huge, it can't clear models effectively other than to sort of wheel around them, which is something all units can do anyway.
Yeah, the flying kind of helps it, you know, get through terrain and things like that, or moving past your own units. But in terms of moving around enemy units, the 3-inch exclusion zone kind of puts a stop to that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it also doesn't have any bonuses to pylon distance, and with its only 1 and 2-inch attacks, it's very predictable. So when you combine the fact that it has a predictable movement and a predictable combat, you can, not easily, but you can definitely mitigate your losses against this thing. You can make sure that it's fighting something weak and disposable that you can just throw away later. Certainly, it must be worth mentioning that when it's wild, it has to charge. So you could, they're rare, but you could end up in situations where it has to charge the opponent's army if you kill the bonded hero, which is very doable for Stormcast, or one of the best armies for that sort of thing. It is it is a behemoth, which means it can't be put into Hunters of the Heartland, which means you can use abilities like Roar, Stomp, other commands on it, or sorry, I should say other monstrous rampages on it. And that's a pretty big downside these days. I think when you're not able to use all that defense and you just take a lot of damage these days.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, being a behemoth also means it competes in battle regiments with other behemoths. So
it competes with other behemoths that aren't heroes.
Like the Leviathan.
Yeah, so like it'll compete with a Leviathan if they're not taking a Leviathan as a battle line. It'll compete with... let's say, like, if you're Ossiac Bone Reapers, it'll compete with, like, a Gothazar Harvester if you want to take this. I mean, not sure why you want to take this in that spot. But, So any army that normally just takes a monster to have some that occupies that behemoth slot, it'll really mess that up. Any army that wants to take artillery, like, if you're a Skaven player and you want some artillery, well, now you have to not be a one-drop anymore.
Yeah.
when we start talking about the Kron Spine, I think what most of us want to know is, what do we do when this thing is sitting across the table from us? And there are a couple of reasonably simple things to keep in mind. The first is, don't feed it anything that will make it go up a level. Don't run your monsters, your Stormdrake Guard, your Stardrake, your Toralon into this thing if you are not absolutely certain that you are going to survive its counterattack. Because every level that it gains is another turn that this thing will be running around the table and attacking stuff. And as we discussed previously, once it goes up to level 3, that's pretty much going to be an entire game of it rampaging across the battlefield. When you are assessing whether or not you should put damage into this, remember that because it's 3d6, you're looking to max out at 18 wounds. Ensure if you do 18 wounds to this, you are absolutely guaranteeing that it will go down a level. Anything less than that starts to increase the chance that your damage that you put into it that turn doesn't count, because it gets negated.
As close to 18 as possible.
Okay. As close.
Basically, yeah.
There's a lot of discussion about doing at least 11 wounds to get you a 50-50 chance. And if that's your only option, I mean, go for it. But you want to get as close to 18 as you can. The closer you get to 18, the more likely you're going to drop this thing a level.
Yeah, I think killing this thing as quick as possible, not letting it just run around and potentially power itself up and kill a lot of your dudes, the sooner you get rid of it, the better. So I would personally just overkill it. Like, pour more damage, do like 23, because it's a dice game. You don't know how much damage you're going to do exactly, right? So if you end up doing 20 plus damage to this thing, that's fine. I'd rather do 6 more damage than I need than 6 less.
Exactly.
Because when you can guarantee something in a dice game, that's very, very important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely, if your option is to not have a good chance of dropping at a level or absolutely guaranteeing it, go for the absolute guarantee. The only time that that even becomes an issue is when the incarnate is included in a list as a distraction piece, which we can talk about later. As we said previously, instant kill effects do reduce it automatically, instantly by 1. So unfortunately, as Stormcast players, we don't really have access to instant kill effects, but it does mean that there are armies out there that can theoretically drop this in 1 turn. Because you can do an instant kill effect like Nagash's Hand of Dust, and then do 18 wounds to it, and at the end of the battle shock phase, it's reduced to 0 and gone.
Right. Assuming it didn't eat a monster in that time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. You're going for broke, because you're trying to get something like Umbral Spell Portal off, get the instant kill spell or effect off, and then do enough damage to it and not give it a monster. There's a lot of sequential things that you have to do to try to kill it in 1 turn. I honestly don't think we're going to see that very often. That's like doing 4 damage to it and the player failing the roll. Like, it's going to happen. It's just going to be super rare.
Yeah, I remember when the new Croak War Scroll came out, and he's got that new effect where you roll based on the number of wounds he takes. First roll I ever did with Croak in a game, you know, I built the model, I put it together, I was really excited. First spell, miscast, take D3 mortal wounds, fail all of my rolls to pass them off to the Source Guard, fail all of my ward rolls, and then I make the roll for Croak, and he dies instantly.
Yep, it's a dice game. It can happen.
So don't ever let that happen. Don't do 17 wounds to a Kron Spine and have your opponent roll triple sixes. Just, it's better not to have that scenario happen.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just, unfortunately, it may not be a situation where you have that option. If you have the option, take it, unless there is something of much greater priority that you need to deal with immediately. But at that point, you're making choices about what is going to kill you. And then, as we've talked about, this thing doesn't go down a level until the battle shock phase, which means if you put melee units into it, it will get a chance to hit back, which means you're better off hitting it from range, if at all possible. Its damages don't degrade, so it will hit you as strong as it started until the end of that turn. And only the most durable units, whether that is because they're ethereal, or they have a really powerful ward save, or they have saves stacked to oblivion, are going to be able to take a hit from this and survive.
Yeah, it's generally a good idea to try to pour as much damage into range as possible. Let's say, looking at our Nagash scenario earlier, if you try to cast Hand of Dust while you're engaged with melee with it, it might lose a level immediately, but then it will probably kill Nagash in combat and gain that level back, and then it won't die in the battle shock phase, even if you did the 18 wounds you need to slay it. It's always better to pour damage into it from range because of how much damage it does itself. And any time it's in melee, you're risking it, the player getting a double turn and it running over your screens and then flying and charging a monster and gaining a level. It's really rough. So playing defensively, treating this thing with respect is generally better. And whatever you
don't run all dragons. Don't run all dragons into this.
Yeah. Avoid storm drakes. Or at least don't put them anywhere near it until it's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. Scions of the Storm is your friend.
Whatever melee units you send into combat with this thing, if they're not, you know, like +3 save protectors, be prepared to lose those units. And so, you know, if you shoot at it one turn and then the next turn your shooting doesn't do quite enough damage, you can charge in with some stuff into the last few wounds. That's a fine strategy. Just remember, those units are probably going to die.
So how to counter the Conspine Incarnate. So always keep focus on the battle plan. Remember, like, this model isn't slain, so lowering its level and causing it to be removed from play is not going to score you any battle tactics, so don't overcommit. Remember, you still need to take objectives in order to win, and this thing counts as 5 models on objectives, but can score bonus victory points for your opponent based on any, like, objective or battle line killing things that they have to do in Gur with a monster. I guess we're waiting on the FAQ if Bring It Down actually does work with the Crossbind being removed from play. Paul, do you want to just, like, expand on this?
It should. I think we talked about it earlier. Because it's removed from play, it is destroyed, because that's how they define destroyed in the rules, but it's not slain. So, like, if you use Bring It Down specifies if this monster is destroyed, you score it. Then it also specifies if it was slain by a weapon, you could score an extra victory point. That part won't work, because this Cronspine is not slain. Hopefully we get an FAQ about this thing soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then when the hero is slain, the hero that it is bonded to, the Incarnate goes wild immediately. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't mean that the controlling player or the owning player loses control of it. It just means that it can charge the closest enemy unit, but this thing can run and charge. So if your opponent's smart, they'll keep it out of, like, that 12-inch charge range that it's out of the 2d6 charge range, is another way to put it. The weird thing is, if people are playing for the domination range on this thing, which is the non-retreat and charge and the aura +1 to hit, they have to keep everything closed, which is sort of like a good thing and bad thing. It means that if it does go wild, it's more liable to also charge its own friendly units and attack them. But it also means, like, if you put this model in the middle of your army, then the opponent's army has to attack your army and this thing too. So that it's sort of a trade-off you do when you position this model anywhere around your army. And then, I guess, like, because this thing prevents retreating, it means the enemy units that it ties up are pretty much, if they're alive, they're going to be tied up the next turn. They're not going to be able to. So if you're a Nighthaunt player, for instance, who loves stacking a wave of terror every turn with retreat and charge, you're not going to be able to do that. And that's a really pretty useful ability. It can work against you if you're stuck fighting chaff, but if retreat and charges for an IDK, like a Deepkin player, Nighthaunt player, are your thing, then you're not going to get to do that.
Yeah, we actually have a really good example of that exact scenario coming up later in this video.
this is about how to countering the Kronzweig Incarnate occur. Ooh, that's tough to say. And yeah, so when you think about units, Paul, I'm thinking protectors myself, but we're not really dropping anything that doesn't have a 2-up save, are we?
You can have some things with a 3-up save survive. I mentioned a Star Drake earlier. I think a Star Drake with Finest Hour, with all that defense, with all these different effects could survive a combat with this guy. It is risky because if you don't, like if it has extra things fighting you that can weaken you down and then the Kronzweig gets the final blow, it powers itself up, which is rough. I think it's fair to assume that the Kronzweig is going to deal, you know, 20 plus damage by itself against even 3-up saves. And it's probably not going to be fighting by itself. It's because of its effects, it wants to be surrounded by other aggressive melee units. So it's not like you're fighting 2,000 points against a Kronzweig. You're fighting an army that has a Kronzweig in it. So it's not a simple matter of just, you know, put one unit in its way. But we definitely recommend putting units in the way. If you've seen our Stormkeep number 9 video, Tactics and Terminology, you'll know all about the Hammer and Anvil tactics. You'll know about the Riposte. If you haven't seen them, I highly recommend checking that video out. If you're a new player, I think it's very useful. And what you want to do is put a cheap, disposable unit up front, and then something that has a powerful counterattack immediately behind it, just outside of the 2.5-inch range that we specified before, because the Kronzweig can only hit something within 2 inches. So if your hammer unit behind your screen is outside of 2 inches, it can pile in because it's within 3, and then it can fight immediately. And that's a good way to put extra wounds on this thing. Highly recommend using any range damage that you can. If you have really long range damage, like if you have some Longstrike Raptors or even Skybolt Bow Adjudicators, you can try to snipe the Bonded Hero and make this guy go wild. Any effects that reduce damage taken, like the Seraphon Scaly Skin or the Cruel Gas Cruciator, those can be really helpful in minimizing the amount of damage that the Kronzweig can do. Instant kill effects are very useful against it, like Nagash's Hand of Dust, because they can immediately reduce its level by 1 outside of the normal Battle Shock roll, and then you could try to kill it at the end of that turn. Monsters, especially, you know, ones that are behind screens, because you don't want to expose them to the Kronzweig. Monsters within 3 inches can use Roar on this guy, because it can't be in Hunters of the Heartland, so it can always get roared. And if it can't use commands, that means or it can't get all-out attack or all-out defense, and that's very, very useful. Any abilities that deal damage on death actually seem to be quite effective on the Kronzweig, because it doesn't trade well. It does a lot of damage, but it takes a lot of damage at the same time. Now, its main defense is trying to kill you before you can hit it. So if you have effects like Blaze of Glory from Stormcast that can deal a bunch of mortal wounds to it after you die, those little chip mortal wounds can add up and be actually quite effective against this guy. If you have an effect like on a 4-up you fight on death, that's also a pretty good effect to have against this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look at a scenario where the Kronzweig is being used to buff the enemy army. So you can see these are just a standard kind of Dawn of War style deployment. On the opponent's side, the red team up top, you can see that he's got a Kronzweig in the middle there and a bunch of units wholly within 10 inches of the domination range, 10 inches being level 2 domination range, that's what it starts with. And these units are within 3 inches of the Kronzweig. So in a situation like this, what we would recommend is to snipe the Bonded Hero. When you kill the Bonded Hero, the Kronzweig goes wild. And because Wild Form Incarnates treat all models as enemies, and all models treat a Wild Incarnate as an enemy, and they're within 3 inches, that means all of these units are now in combat. And because the Kronzweig has an ability that says these units can't retreat, all of these units just have to sit there and fight each other until they're all dead. This is probably the worst thing that could ever happen to somebody using a Kronzweig. And an inexperienced player will fall victim to this at least once. So if you see this scenario happening, absolutely snipe the Bonded Hero. The Kronzweig will kill the enemy army for you.
Yeah, I also think that now that we're seeing armies that can take a Bonded Hero and then leave them in reserve, we might start seeing this deployment style in those armies. So as an example, if we're up against new Nighthaunt and they've put the Bonded Hero in reserve, they could just leave that Bonded Hero in reserve until turn 3 and have the Incarnate run around surrounded. Well, you don't want it surrounded by, because Nighthaunt want to retreat and charge, but you can be getting the benefit of the Incarnate and not have to worry about it getting into your own army so long as that Bonded Hero is safe from enemy attack.
Yep, definitely.
I mean, you're losing out on the all-out attack aura, but yeah, you'll have a monster that's that can roar for you and, you know, do monstrous things for you. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And reroll, run, and charge. There are definitely ways that a player can get around the downsides of the Kron Spine. For example, if you deploy such that one model in the unit is outside of the domination range of 10 inches, then the unit is not wholly within, which means you are not being penalized by your own thing until it's actually your turn. Then on your turn, you move in such a way that when you finish your normal move, you are wholly within 10 inches, so you can reroll charges. And then when you finish your charges, you try to pile in such a way that you are outside of the domination range so that you can still benefit from the all-out attack, but you don't get penalized by the inflamed savagery preventing you from retreating later. So this scenario in particular, you know, if it happens, great. That's like the best thing that could happen to you when you're playing against a Kron Spine. Savvy players won't fall victim to this. This is not a typical high-end scenario. You won't see this happen.
Oh, yeah.
But something that is more likely to happen.
So this is the far more likely scenario that we will see when encountering a Kron Spine in the opponent's army. In this setup, the opponent has deployed their army to one side and then the Kron Spine off by itself holding an entire flank because it can do that all on its own. What we've done here is there are no units within three, which means if the bonded hero gets sniped, the Kron Spine is not locked into combat. It's possible for units to be wholly within the domination range to get the benefit, especially if you move them, like Paul was saying previously, in such a way that in each of the phases, they are able to benefit from its domination effect. But at the end of that phase, you're not locked. You're not prevented from retreating. So if the enemy models closest to the Kron Spine move straight forward with it so that they remain in range, and then they make their charges and charge in opposite directions, you can still get the benefit without any of the drawbacks. This does normally mean that killing the bonded hero is not necessarily going to have an immediate impact. It's more of a delaying tactic, because once the bonded hero is destroyed and the Kron Spine goes wild, now the opponent has to be very careful about where they end up moving their units and moving the Kron Spine, because they don't want to leave their units within range to be potentially charged. It is the safest way to deploy and use the Kron Spine, but you are going to get less effect out of it, or your opponent will get less effect out of it, because you're not going to be able to chain all-out attack. Only certain units will be able to get the rerolls to run and charge. And when you are dealing with this fast flying beat stick, right, you want to avoid engaging it in melee as much as possible. You want to deploy out of its initial threat range so that it does nothing on turn one except maybe advance up the board. They'll give you the opportunity to shoot at it and try to reduce it in wounds. Try to avoid engaging it in melee as much as possible, because it is going to get hit you back. You want to be able to deploy out of its threat range so that it can't charge in on turn one and it's just occupying space on the board. If it is the priority target, you want to get as close to, you want to get up to 18 wounds if possible, and then move on. This becomes very important when you're chaining different attacks. Like if you have shooting from different units, that will allow you to pick a unit, shoot, do damage, see where you end up. If you need to do another unit, then you can, and you just keep checking that until you've hit that 18 wound cap. On turn two, if you have the ability to move cheap units, your screens, something not critical to your army, you can do that and slow it down. This is going to really rely on getting your screens in position, giving it things that it will likely end up charging that are not critical to your army, so that you can set up your counterattacks or your holding patterns while you deal with the remaining portions of the opponent's army. Because in many instances, this thing is going to basically offer you an additional target that you have to deal with. And when you're picking your targets, you have to decide what is going to be most threatening to your force. Is it going to be the Kronspine or something else that the opponent does not want you to shoot? If you're going to throw melee units into this, it's preferable to use something that either is going to do its damage and die, or that's tanky enough to survive the Kronspine's counterattack. If you have to, don't be afraid to sacrifice units, even if it seems like that's not particularly palatable. It is better to slow this thing down and have it not doing something super useful for your opponent than allowing it to just charge into your back lines and start mowing through your units.
Yep, well said. Basic hammer and anvil tactics. You just want to delay this thing, slow it down, and make it fight useless stuff, and then you hit it with your good stuff. Very basic tactics when dealing with any kind of fast-flying monster. If you've played against a Maw Crusher, I would say the Incarnate is probably less threatening than a Maw Crusher. It's also, I'm going to say, easier to kill, because getting through a save stack Maw Crusher is like needing two turns to kill it, unless you can just do a ton of mortal wounds immediately. So let's take a look at an in-game example of luring a Kronspine. So Jack, this was a game you played. Why don't you run us through it?
So these are photos that I took at my final game in the last GT I was at. You can see in the left photo is how my units ended up being redeployed and screened. And on the right is where the Kronspine ended up. I believe this is on turn two. Now, the opponent deployed the Kronspine in that sort of case two, where his army was on the left side of the picture and the Kronspine was off by itself on the right. On turn one, my Raptors shot the hero off the table, causing it to go wild. And from that point on, the Kronspine was basically off on the right side, my right side of the table, for multiple turns, just occupying space. When it finally did get in on starting going into turn two, you can see in the left photo, I've got my Vindictors next to my little box of dice, and on the right photo, they are gone. And what we needed to do was, I did not want the Incarnate charging into my heroes and my tanky Dracothian guard units, or bypassing them and getting into the Raptors. So as the Incarnate moved forward, my Vindictors redeployed, and rather than trying to redeploy out of range to charge, I instead redeployed them as a speed bump. And the thought process was, unless my opponent rolled exceedingly well on his charge roll, he was facing a choice between charging a 130-point unit that was there to die or ending up charging his own units because he couldn't get to anything else. And that is a strategy that you can use to buy time. Because if you can stop the Incarnate from moving where your opponent wants to, block it off, or force it to be very careful about where it positions, you can create zones of exclusion where your opponent will not want to move the Incarnate. And because it's under their control, you can effectively guarantee areas where it won't move. And that will give you breathing room to then do things like move additional units into screen or move your units away.
Right. So here, just to summarize, you've got these Vindictors sitting around. They are redeploying into the Kronspine to prevent it from just running past. It needs a much higher charge roll because the Vindictors are in the way now. It needs a much higher charge roll to get anywhere useful. And the time that those Vindictors bought you gave you the time you needed to reposition your units so that you could basically do it again by dropping another unit in from reserve and repeating that process.
Yeah, and that is correct. The other thing that it's sort of hard to see in melee range with Bellicor at the time was Bastion, and where the Incarnate ended up put Bastion and my Tempestors within domination range so they couldn't retreat. By stopping it dead there, Bastion was able to pile in outside of the domination range and then on the next turn retreat out of combat and start to score battle tactics. Because anyone who's fought Bellicor, who's chain summoning plague bearers every turn, knows you're not killing it.
Right. I like that. That's sneaky. Piling out of the domination range is clutch. All right, so let's talk about some good units for Stormcast in particular to use. We've talked about effects that are just generally good. Unfortunately, Stormcast don't have access to instant kill effects. We don't have access to damage reduction effects like the Seraphon Scaly Skin, and if that ability still exists when this video is live. Let's talk about some good Stormcast units. So right off the bat, I'd say Liberators are up there. They're like one of my favorite units to use for this kind of strategic purpose when you just need something that's cheap, something you don't need for the rest of your battle plan, something that just gets in the way of melee units, and sometimes even survives a combat and does it for two turns in a row because they do basically have a 3-up save. So Liberators are great. Kronspine hates fighting them, so feed it as many Liberators as you can. And then on the opposite side of that spectrum, I'd say Protectors are filling a really good role here. Because if you go all out defense, and you can guarantee it, if you're in Hunters of the Heartland, it can't be roared. And you get another plus one save from, let's say, Mystic Shield or Lord Castellant. If you reinforce those Protectors, you can reliably survive combat with a level 3 Kronspine. That's the max damage it can do. And Protectors are just shrugging it off, which is just great. They are slow, so any list that's using them, you know, you have to really tailor the rest of your list. But in a vacuum, Protectors are a fantastic unit to have against units exactly like this that are trying to charge into your ranks. Protectors just laugh it off. Annihilators are very similar to Protectors because they have a 2+ save as well. But the difference is that with a Lord Imperitant, they can be deployed, you know, more than 7 inches away and reroll a charge. So pretty reliably, you can tie it down anywhere on the board. So right off the bat, if you're very clever with your positioning, you can charge into combat with a squad of, let's say, 3 or 6 Annihilators, tie down the Kronspine, pop all out defense, and hold as much of the enemy army in place as you can while you maybe get fancy and you snipe the Bonded Hero, and now everything there is just fighting to the death. So that is it could be a very useful tactic. Now, obviously, Annihilators are not the best units right now to use in every list, but if you happen to have them in your army, then that's a pretty good matchup, I'd say. Now, unlike Protectors, they have less wounds, so a couple bad rolls could just kill the unit, because you only have 9 wounds per squad instead of the 15. And when you reinforce them, because they only have 1-inch range, their damage isn't the best. So you still will need supporting damage. It's not like the Annihilators can do enough to bracket, or, you know, air quote bracket, the Kronspine properly down a level. I'm a big fan of Gardas Steel Soul in general, but a 5+ ward aura giving you a 50% increase in effective health is really strong in a Stormcast army when we already have really high effective health from our save bonuses. So if you have a unit of Liberators and you give them some save bonuses and they get some good rolls, you know, they don't get terribly unlucky, with a Gardas Steel Soul Aura, you might even be able to survive a combat with that kind of disposable unit. So those kinds of plays are enabled when you have a 50% increase in effective health. Your screens are probably going to die, you know, but maybe they won't. And maybe some of your more durable units, like if you have a squad of Stormdrake Guard, maybe the 5-up ward is what you need in order to survive a combat with the Kronspine. I still don't recommend fighting Kronspine with Stormdrake Guard, but if you're in that scenario, it's good to have Gardas.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of shooting output, I would recommend the Judicators with Boltstorm crossbows the most. They have the highest damage output from any Stormcast shooting unit. When you double reinforce them and give them all-out attack, one volley will deal about 20 damage to a 4+ save, which is more than enough to kill, or let's say, D-level a Kronspine with one volley. And that's a really good use of your resources. Now, that is an average roll. Sometimes you might roll a little bit lower, so it's a good idea to have like a backup shooting unit, like maybe like a Knight Judicator or some light mortal wounds here and there. And the big downside of the Boltstorm Judicators is that they have a shorter range. They're only 18 inches, which can make it very difficult to hit the Bonded Hero. And if you're in range to shoot the Kronspine at 18 inches, it is in range to charge you, so you absolutely have to have screens because this thing's guaranteed to survive that one turn, so you better drop some Liberators in front of these guys to protect yourself. Judicators with Skybolt bows are an interesting alternative to the Boltstorm crossbows. They have a little bit less damage, and I think you might need more supporting shooting in order to make them work, but they have longer range, which means the Kronspine can't charge you until after you shoot it, because 24 inches puts enough distance there. Probably still want to bring screens, but the longer range does make them better for trying to snipe down the bonded hero. And then naturally, the Vanguard Raptors with long strike crossbows. They have the longest range, 30 inches. It means the Kronspine needs two turns to get to you. Even when it's running and charging, it's not going to get you unless it happens to roll a 12 on the charge and it's perfectly in range and there's nothing in the way. So that kind of range is very useful from a tactical perspective. The long strike Raptors have a very small footprint, which means it's very easy to get the models in range to shoot, both regular shooting and if you're doing an Unleash Hell, you can even pour some damage in there on that. On your enemy's turn, they have lower damage than Boltstorm crossbows, overall, but they are more reliable because they're on threes and twos with Ren 2. That just means you're less likely to roll low. They have higher rend, and they deal mortal wounds on hit rolls of 6. Now, they only deal about 15 damage to a 4-up per volley, so you will need additional shooting support, but it's very reliably 15 damage. It's not as swingy as the Boltstorm crossbows.
Another great unit that's I really love against the Kronspine Incarnate is the Knight Judicator. Ren minus 3, cut through the save. 30-inch range means there's a good chance you'll get two volleys off, especially if you get the double turn. You can also take down the bonded hero with it with a bit of luck. With an all-out attack, you can hit on threes, wound on twos. Maybe not on its own, but yeah, in conjunction with other Knight Judicators or maybe a squad of Judicators and Raptors, it can really help reduce the impact of the Kronspine Incarnate or its bonded hero on the field. And the same goes for Tempestors. They're probably not going to snipe any heroes, limited as they are with their range, but with their insane volley fire and the mortal wounds from the Drakkoth Breath, they can can bring the Kronspine Incarnate to a level where it has a reasonable chance of falling down a level without having to engage it in melee and having risk them being blown off the board. You can also really hurt the Kronspine Incarnate using Unleash Hell by, sitting this unit behind a unit of Liberators. If you add Gardas to that mix, then it gets even better. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of opponents are going to expect losing a level on their own phase to Unleash Hell and then fighting with these Drakkoths, because they are still 3 attacks apiece, Ren 2, 2 damage, and that sort of thing is very good at fighting the Kronspine.
Having the Kronspine charge a unit of 2 Tempestors, who then unleashed hell and fought in the combat phase, is how I destroyed the Incarnate in my first tournament matchup with what they're okay. Like, Unleash Hell is not going to drop the Kronspine a level by itself with Tempestors, but if they get a chance to fight with both models, or if you've reinforced them, you can reliably drop it a level in one turn that way.
Yeah, Tempestors are great. They shoot like crossbow adjudicators, and then they fight almost like retributors. They're pretty decent models. All right, guys. Hopefully this has been a useful tool for you to understand how a Kronspine works, what players are trying to do with it, and some general tips about what to do against it. If you're a Stormcast player, hopefully these unit recommendations are something you can fit into your list. I think if you end up facing a Kronspine, you'll be quite pleased at including any of these units.
If you have your own thoughts on strategies, especially something that you have seen in your games that has worked very well that we didn't cover, hit it up in the comments and let us know, because we would like to hear other people's perspectives and experiences with it.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on how to counter this thing. It is a new model. It's got its own unique new rule set. So we're just kind of looking at it more or less like another fast flying beat stick that just takes 2 turns to kill. But if you have some cool combo or some tech that you think we missed, drop it in the comments and we'd love to take a look at it. And that does it for this episode. Thanks everybody for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next one.
See you next time, guys.
Thanks, everybody.